be right at the front, but also I wouldn't turn up for another couple of hours. I don't know why people do such things. I'm just really respectful of the people who come to my talk and kind to them. So anyway, the topic of the talk this evening is somebody again sent an email to me and they asked, can you please talk about this because it seems to have been in the news recently. It was a BBC little documentary about this, and there was also an article which somebody showed me about the dangers of meditation. Now, you don't have to worry here, because the type of meditation you get here, honestly, it is the best. Not just because I teach it, but because it is really fundamental, real Buddhist meditation, just similar to what the Buddha taught, how Ajahn Chah taught, and it's been tested over, I've been here for 33 years now in Western Australia, and you can see how many people it's helped. So this is really, really good meditation. But some of the other types of meditation, I don't even really call it meditation, I call it mad-itation, makes you mad. Or the mindfulness is mind-foolishness, not mindfulness. And I will explain what I mean and how the whole business of mindfulness meditation, which has only very recently occurred, is actually causing a little bit of problems for people. And even you may get some criticism, you know, from your friends. Oh, be careful of going to those Buddhist monasteries. You'll go mad. You'll go crazy. But first of all, I would say more people go mad and crazy by not meditating than anyone ever goes by meditating. You know, it does really, really work and make you very peaceful and happy. But the whole movement started off, as many of you may know, by a Buddhist called Jon Kabat-Zinn, who wanted to introduce some of the great benefits of meditation more widely. Many people have just got a lot of cynicism towards religion, and anything which is religious, even without having to look at it or testing it out or judging it on its merits, just because it's religious, they would tend to just dismiss it as like gobbledygook and just for the gullible, which is one of the reasons why now, you know, you don't even talk about religion, we talk about spirituality. Just the same thing, but just give it a different name. It's called marketing. Just like you get a product and you just rename it, hopefully that people will buy it. But spirituality rather than religion, because it has a bad name. And it was because of that that meditation was not going to work in many places. And even recently I was talking to a Greek Orthodox priest. And apparently that he got word from his superior that yoga is really not the sort of thing any Christian should do. It's evil, it's the work of the devil. The problem was this pastor here in Perth, he actually does yoga with his wife every week. And so the problem was that he said, why are these scholars? They're just not really understanding what's going on. And you know, it works. There's nothing really bad or evil about having some exercises and stretching and becoming aware of your body. But it was because, you know, of that religion and sometimes the power which religious leaders have that people like Kabat-Zinn said, well, let's not call it meditation, let's call it mindfulness. And it was a neutral word which it could actually spread, and it worked much better than he ever expected. Which means that mindfulness is such a really, really big word. And now there are organizations, you can go and pay a lot of money, I mean talking about tens of thousands of dollars, to be accredited as a mindfulness teacher. But I often ask, well, who accredited those people who accredited others? We didn't. And remember, as a Buddhist monks, we started mindfulness and meditation. That's where it started from. But instead of just calling it mindfulness, we have a much, much wider grasp of its context. And you hear me saying now, it's really, really important to actually not just take mindfulness out of context, but also support it with the most important factor, which is kindness, compassion, gentleness, and also a little bit of restraint as well, which is the precepts, a bit of goodness in your life. And and also, of course, wisdom as well. It's not just mindfulness, it is other things as well. And if you just take off mindfulness out of context, some people do have problems. Because, first of all, meditation was never meant to be harsh and forceful. And it's been very hard for me to try and encourage people not to force their bodies. And I remember this from one of my fellow monks who I grew up with. He heard that if you really want to become enlightened, you have to have very strong willpower. And that the only way to get enlightened is to sit all night and not move. And he did that. He crossed his legs. He sat all night without moving, even though he had such great pain. Do you think that was really a courageous, wonderful, heroic thing to do? For me, no, it was absolutely stupid, because the following morning we had to take him to hospital. Honestly, true, for a double knee reconstruction. Yeah, I mean, it's tough. You can admire his endurance, but his stupidity was, you know, Guinness Book of Records class. But still, people love to do that sort of stuff. And they always think, no pain, no gain. But that's not Buddhism. You know, religion has always been associated with pain, with monks flogging themselves, people naming themselves up onto crosses and doing all these big fasts. Does it look like I fast? Fast food, yeah. But not the other type of fasting. And sometimes people criticize, that's your problem, look at you, you're too fat, you should be tougher, you should be meditate longer, you should be more disciplined. I said, actually, that's not the way. I've seen that, tried it, and it does not work. That harshness. And for me, there was something which, when I was layperson, I was English. When I first came across Buddhism, actually even religion, what I was really impressed with was its kindness, its love, its compassion. And then when you went to some of these meditation retreats, they actually used a stick and they hit people with the stick. Where's compassion gone now? That's not a compassionate thing to do. And it also doesn't work either. Because I do travel. And when I travel, I get all the latest gossip. This is not latest, this is old gossip, because I was in Hong Kong. And I was sitting around having a cup of tea with a monk from mainland China. And they're telling me all the news, what's happening over there with Buddhism in mainland China. And he said there was a Chinese monk teaching a meditation retreat. And during the retreat, one of the elderly Chinese women started to fall asleep while they were meditating. And the teacher got the stick and whacked her on the back. And she immediately took out her smartphone, turned it on, and called the police. And the police came and arrested that monk and took him away. That was the end of the meditation retreat. You cannot do that these days. That's a true story. It's all the gossip which you... But, now, what are you doing that for? You don't need to do that. Where's the kindness, compassion? And because there is that inclination of people, they think that if you really want to get anywhere in life, you have to struggle and strive. That force is the way for success. It may work, you know, if you're playing sort of football, or if you may be even in the workforce, but even I doubt that. But if it's in spirituality and meditation in real life, please lessen your forcefulness and have more kindness. That's far, far more effective. You can imagine just with even police officers, using force is always conflict. Using some kindfulness, wisdom, it tends to diffuse conflict. I'm just remembering about one of our monks. Not all the people who become monks and nuns, you know, survive and become a monk to the end of their life. You know, some stay for a while and then they disrobe. And this young man, you know, he was a monk with me for a while and then he disrobed. And you know the job he got? He got a job as a bouncer in one of the nightclubs in Northbridge. And it was the next monk doing as a bouncer, and he was not a big guy. You know, he's one of the smaller guys in our monastery. And what is a small guy who's not very strong, you know, being as a bouncer in a nightclub? And when I talked to him, you know, I asked him, what are you doing that for? And, you know, he told me I was stupid. I did, obviously, once he explained it to me, oh yeah, I understand now. He was so wise and kind. He could diffuse situations without needing to be big and strong. Just, you know, his emotional intelligence was really very, very good. So when anybody, you know, they wanted to get in, they couldn't get in because the nightclub was full or they were creating problems because they drank too much or had drugs or whatever, he could actually talk to them in a beautiful, kind way, in a wise way, non-threatening, and just basically lead them out without any violence. His emotional intelligence made him a very, very successful bouncer. He didn't need to be big and forceful. And that is an example of many, that, you know, the kindness and the wisdom is more powerful than force. But when people are encouraged to use force in their meditation, and they are not encouraged in the opposite direction by their teacher, you know, to let go, be kind, be gentle, then you find that some people, not all, some people become so fragile that they do get hurt in meditation, sometimes physically, or they get pushed to such a degree that they don't know how to get out. So that's one of the first problems in meditation. For goodness sake, don't use so much force. And don't sort of have all these great resolutions, I'm going to sit for 3 or 4 hours. Always, there is no such thing as 3 or 4 hours if you have any wisdom. There's only this moment. And that's where, how I meditate. I don't look at a clock and see how long I'm going to meditate for. Ajahn Chah was so good in the way he taught me, because he said, sitting long periods of time is not really the point. If it was important, he said, then all the chickens in Thailand who sit still on their eggs for 6-7 hours at a time, all the chickens in Thailand will be enlightened by now. Sitting long periods of time is not the most important thing to do. So to this day I call that chicken meditation, seeing how long you can sit for, 2 hours. You know, I'll do 3 hours. 3 hours, that's nothing. I'll do 4 hours. That's just one chicken talking to another chicken. But it's not that which is important. It's the quality and the being in the present moment. Because otherwise, you can see with that force, or with that trying to beat your records, or trying to get somewhere, that causes a lot of tension in the mind. And that tension, that tightness in the mind, wanting to achieve something, that is what's dangerous in meditation. And because most of you were here when I was teaching just at the beginning, for the first half an hour, I think you probably have understood that that tightness was not part of the meditation which I taught. Just let things be, relax, and actually see the agitation, the tightness of the body and the mind, and never move in that direction, moving in the opposite direction. And that's not just with meditation, that's with your life as well. Don't force things, don't try and force your children or force your wife or your husband to do things. There's much better ways. And also don't force yourself and push yourself too much. Work wisely, smartly, not forcefully. How many times, you know, when people are working hard, when they're tired, they don't take a rest. Productivity goes down, your brain doesn't work when you're really tired. And you're wasting your time. You can see, I've seen kids do this, they sit in front of the computer for half an hour or an hour, and they hardly produce anything, because their brain ain't working. And if that half an hour now they just relax, rest, and get their brain alive again, then they could produce really good work very quickly. You waste so much time by not working wisely and using force instead. So that's why what works in meditation actually works in life as well. But it's also, there are some people who, that's not using force, there's some people who are, again, wounded. We're all damaged by our past. We've all got this stuff which at the time was very hard to bear, the psychological or even physical wounds, you know, in our life so far. And for many of us, those get suppressed because they're just too difficult or too painful to bear. And I'm going to go back to a simile which only came up just this last August when I met my old friend, the professor of physics, Bernard Carr. And this was such a seminal piece of science, such an important piece. I keep on repeating this, but I'm going to interpret this in a way which I haven't interpreted before. That was the experiment which was done at Imperial College in London. And it was an amazing experiment because this was in front of professors of science, lecturers, hard-nosed research scientists. And they were all invited into this lecture theatre in Imperial College in London, and this fellow, a good friend of Bernard, Professor Bernard Carr, he came in there with a flower pot and put the flower pot on the desk and announced to all his friends in the science field, he will now demonstrate levitation, which was a crazy thing to say. But, you know, scientists, well, they're already there, see what happened. And the even more amazing thing was that he asked all these scientists to create the right atmosphere by chanting Om. And they all did it. Now, that was a miracle to get all these scientists to chant Om. Imagine doing that at UWA. Professor David Blair would probably never do that. He's a good friend. But they all did that. And they're all chanting Om, 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 a whole lecture theatre full of scientists. And the flower pot levitated. It rose, and there's no strings, no wires. It actually levitated. It rose up in the air. They had the cameras on it. Recorded it. A flower pot in a laboratory, in front of the cameras, in front of the most sceptical audience you could imagine, it levitated in the air. Now, of course, those of you who've heard this before, what was actually happening, but this was not the important part of the experiment, there was this huge electromagnet underneath the desk. And the reason they all had to chant Om, Om, Om was to mask, you know, the hum of this high amperage current which was necessary to make this rise. But that, it was a trick, but that wasn't the point of the experiment. The point was, he asked many of his professors what happened, and many of them said it never rose. It was on the table all the time. They never saw it. It's not as if they saw it and they didn't believe their eyes. It never actually came to their conscious part of their mind. It was stopped. It was blocked before they were even conscious of it. It was so against their worldview, they literally did not see it. That is how much we bend our perceptions, how we can hide the truth. And that is one of the reasons why, when you do have difficult experiences in life, traumas, pains, where you're feared for your life sometimes, or a terrible event is happening, especially when you're young and you feel so vulnerable, you're not aware of that. You hide it, suppress it. It's in your body or your mind somewhere. And what happens sometimes with those people, we've all got some parts of that, those old memories which were suppressed, hidden, too painful to bear, like those scientists, it was too painful to their views of what's possible to see a flower pot levitated, so they hid it. But it was there. And sometimes when we do meditation, sometimes we actually access that and it starts coming up. And so these are painful memories, difficult memories, which can sometimes come up when you meditate. And if you don't know how to deal with them, if you try and suppress them, or get upset at them, or afraid of them, That's when you feed them all the energy. And that's where some of these stories I read about people who meditate and they get these anxiety attacks, panic attacks, and they sometimes are hospitalized because of it. I disagree with the hospitalization. If it's a meditation problem, meditation solutions can actually solve the problem instead of putting people into an institution for a few months. Unfortunately, that yes, meditation works, but many of the people who are in the psychology field, they don't know enough about meditation, they overreact, and they just give you chemicals, medication, which is not the right thing. But anyway, the right way of doing this is if we could only have the compassion involved, and then it is so simple to deal with those problems. Because you will find if you feel safe, if you feel, and kindness gives you that feeling of safety. When you're with really, really kind people, you feel that nothing can harm you. So if in the arms of compassion, you never feel as safe as when you have that. And that means that these things can actually come up. I was just, when I was thinking about giving this talk, when I read the email this evening, I always remember that one of the most important parts of healing is having carers. That's what they call doctors and nurses and therapists and physiotherapists. They call them carers. And that's an important part, you know, of our medicine. We care. And of course, sometimes in present-day hospitals, it's become more of an industry, more like a factory than actually caring for people, which is, I think, one of the reasons why it's wonderful that people are really sick, treat them at home, they're dying, put them in home and care for them. It actually works. Okay, there's one little story, which is a great story. I'm not sure if I've told this a couple of weeks ago, but one of the old friends, a really nice guy, he was put in the hospice in Murdoch. I love this story, even if you heard it before. I just love telling these stories. This fellow was put in Murdoch Hospice. He was dying of cancer. And first night in hospital, the nurse, the carer, "What do you want for dinner this evening?" You know, they like to look after people so much, say, "Whatever you want, we'll cook it for you. We'll go and buy it and cook it." That's like the hospital. It's a really nice place. And so he told the nurse, "Well, I've got diabetes, so it can't have anything with sugar in. I've got high cholesterol, so no oil or grease or fat is out. And heart and arteries, so no salt, please." And had this whole list of stuff he couldn't eat. And the nurse looked at him as if he was a crazy man. Said, "What on earth are you talking about? You're not going to die of diabetes or cholesterol. You're going to die of cancer in a few days. You can eat whatever you want." And he was so surprised, pleasantly. "Really? Because for the last 3 or 4 years, my wife would not let me eat any of that stuff." So for the first time in those 3 or 4 years, he could eat the unhealthy, greasy, sugary, salty food which he'd craved for and missed for such a long time. He could eat whatever he wanted. You know what happened? In a week's time, they released him from the hospice because he got better. he walked out, he went home. And apparently, about 6 months later, he went back again to what I call dying properly in this time. But it gave him an extra few months of life, just eating what he liked eating. That just caring. He was being cared for. And that caring for himself and caring for, you know, from others, that was incredibly therapeutic. Caring is actually a positive thing. You know, for your well-being, psychologically as well as physically. And that's one of the things which I found was missing in many types of meditation. Mindfulness was just so cold, clinical, plastic. I don't know why I called it clinical. But it's true, isn't it? We call it clinical. There's no warmth and kindness there. That is a problem with modern-day hospitals and doctors. No kindness. Well, there's kindness. Some doctors are brilliant, but some are just so overworked they haven't got time to be kind. They haven't got time to cure people. So the caring profession, it should really be caring. And meditation should also have that care there. And I'll tell you how it works. This is one of the very key stories from Buddhism. It's actually taught by the Buddha. And I don't just repeat what the Buddha said. I take the essence of it and I expand it into modern times. And this simile is one of the most powerful. And I haven't said it enough recently. It was a monster in the Emperor's palace simile. And this, when I read this and embellished it to make it more powerful, oh, it's a brilliant simile. Once there was a monster who came into an emperor, let's make it 21st century, into an empress's palace. Why do always have to be emperors? You know, when I was in Hong Kong recently, they always call me master, because that's, if you're a teacher and a senior monk, they call you master. And they would say, yes, master, no, master. And I said, do you even call the nuns master as well, or do you call them mistress? And they say, actually, we don't call them mistress in Hong Kong, because that might get misunderstood. So if Venerable Hasapanya went to Hong Kong, she should, you know, don't be so gender specific. She should be called Mistress Hasapanya. The master, I said, no, you can't do things like that. But anyway, this empress was away when this really nasty, smelly, frightening monster came into the palace. And because it was so big and terrifying, the guards, like we have security guards outside every Friday. Now imagine there was this big bikey, which was 10 foot tall, you know, that's 10 foot wide. And those probably, security guards would probably hide behind the fences and stuff like that, as normal people will. We're not getting that, paid that amount from our Buddhists to actually risk our life for these people. But, the same in the palace. These guards and soldiers, they just hid. They went in the cupboards, hid under the benches or the beds, anywhere, because this was a really nasty-looking monster. And that allowed the monster to go right inside the palace, right inside the main hall, and then sit on the empress's throne. And as soon as it went onto the empress's throne, that was one step too far. So the soldiers, security guards came out and said, "Get out. You've gone too far." And they took out their swords and other sort of implements. "Get out, now!" And of those few unkind words, that monster grew an inch bigger, more frightening, more ugly, and more stinky. And that really upset people, so they threatened and they cursed, and they just really scolded that demon, "Get out, we'll come out your butt." Really, really mean. But every unkind word, unkind deed, even unkind thoughts, the monster just grew always bigger, more ugly, more smelly, more offensive. And by the time the empress came back, this monster was huge. It was so big it was taking up half the hall. And it was so frightening. When I tell this story, because I haven't seen these movies, people tell me the most frightening monster in the movies was actually done by Steven Spielberg, the Aliens? People still say the Alien is the most frightening monster. This monster makes Alien look like a pussycat. This was 10 times more frightening than Alien. And smelly? The stench was so bad that even the maggots crawling on this monster's skin, they threw up, they were sick. Not even maggots could stand the smell. But the empress, the reason why she was a boss was because of all the people in that country, she was the wisest. And she showed the reason why she was empress. She saw that monster and realized what to do straight away. Welcome she said to the monster, "Has anyone got you anything to drink or eat yet? We can give you a cup of tea. We have English breakfast, we have Dilma, we have double strength, we have peppermint tea. What about something to eat? Would you like some vegetarian food, or how about a pizza? You can get monster-sized pizza now from some of these places." And those few sincerely kind words, that monster grew an inch smaller, less ugly, less smelly, less offensive. It shrank. And everybody saw the problem and the solution. They were feeding this monster with anger, irritation, negativity. So they turned around and they started being kind to the monster. About 10 of them, they went around to the monster's foot. It was so huge, and gave him a foot massage. Have you ever had a foot massage? It's really nice. And the monster said, "Just a bit over there." "Oh yeah, just there, that's just nice." "Oh yeah, thank you so much." Someone gave a shoulder massage. Big head like that, you're going to have pain in your shoulders. Every kind act, odd word, the monster kept on shrinking. And they laid on the kindness so much that soon, in a very amazingly short time, the monster was back down to the size when he first came in. But they never stopped. They kept on being kind and kind and kind until the monster was so tiny that one more act of kindness and the monster vanished away, shrank away. And the Buddha told that story. He called those anger-eating monsters. They feed on anger. The more anger you give them, the bigger they get, the more of a problem they become, the more frightening they become. And there's so many of those hidden traumas in your body, in your mind, in your emotional world. They are anger-eating monsters. "Get out of here, you don't belong. I don't want to feel like this. Get out! You don't belong in my life." You give them anger, they get worse. And that's what some stupid, please excuse me, stupid meditation teacher said. "I just let it go. Just get rid of it. Drop it." That is feeding the monster. Instead, if we have the kindness with the meditation, always have the kindness, from the beginning, middle, the end, "Welcome, monster, that's okay, you'll be alright, never mind." And it's beautiful softness and kindness, because it's the kindness that takes away the harshness, the heaviness, the sharpness of everything. And so if a problem does come up, you treat it with kindness, instead of trying to get rid of it. And the kindness also stops the fear. Remember, sometimes if you're afraid of monsters under the bed, or you're afraid of thieves or robbers, or your brother or something, whoever was scaring you when you were tiny, and a mother came into the room and was just kind to you, father told you a story, the kindness also takes away fear. Makes you feel safe. It feels that you're okay, you're protected. And with that kindness, you'll find that you feel safe enough that some of these things which could cause a psychosis for a person without that kindness, it just comes and it just goes so easily with the kindness there. And in fact, during the meditations which I've been teaching, I've been using that so much, even severe anxiety disappears. When I was in Hong Kong, I did give a lecture to the professors and doctors, not the students, at Prince of Wales Hospital in Hong Kong. It's on the Hong Kong Island. It's one of the main hospitals there. And when I was mentioning just how, not mindfulness, but mindfulness plus kindness, I gave it this new term, kindfulness. Kindfulness. In fact, I've been using that term for a couple of years now, and so there's actually a book out now called Kindfulness. Have you got it in our library now? Kindfulness. I've seen it in the bookshops. It's called Kindfulness. Not mindfulness, but kindfulness. Change the M into a K And it also gives it this more powerful and safe alternative to simple mindfulness. Because you had that kindness there to anxiety. And it's just so easy to take anxiety and just to, with compassion and kindness, to see it melt away. You know, I've said this many times, just remember from my own life. Growing up in a poor part of London, spending too much time playing soccer in the streets, and falling over many times, going for a tackle. And on my memory of my childhood was always having scabs on my knees, dried blood from all the wounds, just falling over. And then they scraped the skin off, and just blood would come out. It was painful. But I'd always run to my mother, and she would kneel down, kiss it better. And that kindness would always take the pain away. I thought that was normal, because that's how you grow up. You never questioned it. You know, if you have pain, get a kiss from your mother, and ten seconds later, I was chasing the ball again as if nothing happened. And it always worked. And I remember that type of kindness, it's amazing how it can take the pain away, the stress, the tightness, which causes, you know, the problems of anxiety. Being kind to the pain, being kind to the anxiety. The anxiety is an anger-eating monster. Comes into your life. What do people say? Get out of here, I don't like you, I don't want to be anxious, I don't want to feel like this. That's why it gets worse. You're feeding it. You're kind to, okay, monster, anxiety, you can be here. It's alright, I can learn how to deal with it. Feel it and just, okay, fine. It gets less then. Because the mindfulness which I taught at the beginning, the mindfulness is to give you feedback to find out how these problems actually get less. And actually, you actually learn what kindness is. I was talking to somebody in my retreat which I gave in Hong Kong a couple of weeks ago. They're just like an ordinary 21st century woman, but she was honest. She said, I don't really know how to be kind. She was honest. So many of you sometimes, you understand the word, you can spell it, but do you really understand how to be kind? If you don't understand how to be kind, how can you be kind to other people? How can you be kind to yourself? But this is actually how you learn what it is. You take a problem. Does it make it worse? Does it make it better? What's going on? What actually changes things for the better? And you actually find out after a while of practicing this mindfulness where you get feedback, you find actually the kindness is what relaxes. The care makes things be free. You heal. So that kindness, if we can only have that kindness in meditation, then people would have no problems at all when they meditate. And they would find that they can go fine. Sometimes people have asked me the question, so that's with the problem with I see with the mindfulness where there's no kindness included at all, no wisdom. That I think is where many of the problems are coming up with this huge mindfulness movement. Most people are okay, but there are some people who are fragile. Without that kindness to soften them, their heart, as little knock can they break, they crack. And that's just so sad. A little bit of kindness, they would have been fine. But it's also that sometimes people say the danger of mindfulness and meditation, can you meditate by yourself? Is that dangerous? And you know what I answered when someone said that this just a few minutes ago while I was in the reception area? I said, well look, it's probably meditating by yourself is less dangerous than meditating with a bad teacher. Meditating with a bad teacher is probably the worst. Meditating with a good teacher is better than meditating by yourself. But meditating by yourself is not that hard, especially these days when you don't need to meditate by yourself even if you're alone. What I mean by that, you may be in the middle of the desert somewhere and there's not a Buddhist monk or a nun or a teacher within a thousand miles, but there is always your tablet or smartphone. And you can carry your favorite monk or nun teacher even to the moon or into the space lab or whatever it is, International Space Lab. Which means that you have a monk, teacher, whatever, wherever you are. And for many people, they keep saying to me that it's so hard to meditate because they keep falling asleep or they keep thinking too much and they have a lot of trouble. Why don't you actually get out your smartphone or tablet, download a guided meditation, something which is useful for you. The ones you like the most, is hundreds of them. And please use the ones from the BSWA site because these are cheap. You don't pay for them. Some of these other sites, you have to pay a lot of money to get a guided meditation from Deepak Chopra. He's got enough money already. He doesn't need anything. Here at Buddhist Society, we undercut the market because we want to get rid of these scallywags. So price them out, because you get the best ones here and they're the cheapest. Price them out so all this other material stuff, which is perverting the real beautiful mindfulness and kindness, can actually fall away. So anyway, get them on your smartphone or your tablet, and then you can listen to it anywhere. And people who say, well, Ajahn Brahm, what if I listen to it in the toilet? Is that bad karma? No, it is not. People are so weird. They think that, well, where do you get that from? Buddhism isn't Christianity. You can just listen to it whatever you want. Some of these traditions and rituals, there was a case once, I will never forget this. One of our past presidents, you know, was a woman. I won't say who she was, but, you know, because I'm the senior monk and I got lots of stuff, you always have to contact the president about this, that and the other. So I had something and I called her up. And she said, hi, it's, I won't say what her real name is, say Susan. Susan here. So it's Ajahn Brahm. Oh, Ajahn Brahm, can I call you later? No, it's really important. I said, but, what's the problem? She said, I'm in the shower, I'm naked. It's not appropriate to talk to a monk on the telephone when I'm naked. I said, listen, I can't see you, lady. Talk. It's crazy. Just because you're naked in the shower, if it's a Skype message, okay, fair enough. Hang up. But on a telephone, what are you on about? So, what's you on about? If you need to listen to it on the toilet, anywhere, if it can relax you, make you peaceful, take away some of the pressures and problems of life, go for it. I don't really care about that, nor should you. So that means you can always have some teaching with you. So you don't need to meditate alone. So the whole problem, is it dangerous to meditate alone? Nowadays you don't need to. You can get all the instructions on your smartphone. So you pull them in there and listen to the monks sort of brainwashing you and it works. So it means, you know, you're perfectly safe. But to me, when I sort of read these articles and I think, this is just a beautiful teaching. It's given me so much happiness and other people so much freedom and joy. And even last night when I was in Sydney last night giving a talk because there's a poor gentleman who lost his daughter from suicide last year, and a couple of weeks ago his wife was killed, his ex-wife was killed. So the poor fellow was in a really bad state, so they wanted me to give a talk on forgiveness. And sometimes people say, well, how can you forgive anybody? Sometimes it's just they've done too much harm, or you've done too much bad stuff, so how can you ever do that forgiveness? And you think you know what I mean. And I said, well, forgiveness is like a prison. And if you've been in that prison for so many years, that how do you get out? You don't want to get out. You're comfortable in that prison. And the alternative is just too scary. It's always that simile. And I use this because you know this. And this is so similar to the inability to let go of some of the emotional problems of life. We get used to them. The simile of a man who's been in prison for 30 years. Tomorrow they'll get released. And they just can't stand it. They're terrified. They don't want to leave. They've got used to the suffering of prison. That's their home. That's where they're they think they belong. Anger, revenge, self, lack of self-worth, whatever it is, guilt. Some of us have had that for so long that it's too difficult to let it go. Just like being in prison for 30 years and tomorrow we just can't walk out the door. We're too scared. So what is the solution? If it's in a real prison, the solution is you let a person out for the day release first of all. They're going to go back again. It's only for a day, okay, for a few hours. And then you go back. And then maybe a weekend. Maybe for a whole week. And then you let them out totally. You have to have this gradual accommodation to freedom. Because you can't take it all in one go. And then that's what happens with meditation. Just a simple little bit of meditation for half an hour. And you're free for half an hour, only half an hour. It all comes back again afterwards. But for half an hour, you feel what it's like to be free of guilt, free of anger, free of all these other anxieties. You feel what it's like. It's like not day release, but half hour release. And after a while, you get used to that. And after a while, you realize you can let it go, you can forgive, because you get used to it. That is how it works. So that's why this meditation is such a powerful thing. It's part of the forgiveness process. For half an hour you're forgiven, because it's not a problem anymore. You know what it's like to have this terrible, terrible burden on you. It's not there for half an hour. It makes it easier for you to let it go sooner or later, once and for all. And to get out of that prison of the past and be truly free. So if people have any of these anxieties or any of these flashbacks of terrible things which happened in the past from the meditation, with the kindness, it's going to be very soft and easy to handle. With the kindness, it's going to be very easy to find solutions to. You're not feeding it with anger. It's a monster who actually shrinks with the kindness. And also, with the kindness, you get used to letting it go for a short time, so that when you come back afterwards, out of meditation, you can let it go once and for all. That's how it works. So those are the problems of mindfulness, in brief, and also some of the solutions. And in summary, please, use the kindness and your wisdom as well. And please don't use this willpower business. I've seen that too often just cause so much harm. And that's one of the reasons why when I teach a retreat, I will never force you. I'll never tell you what to do. Many of you have seen me teach for such a long time. I teach with kindness, with softness, with gentleness. I've never used a Zen stick on anybody. And never will, because I know it doesn't work and it's also very dangerous. And that way, this wonderful part of Buddhism meditation, it can help so many, many, many people, and people won't be put off by these reports which come in places like the BBC from people who are not really know how to teach it properly. So thank you for listening. Sadhu, great. Okay, let's have some questions. I didn't tell any jokes today. I'm so sorry about that. Maybe there was this Irishman told me this joke yesterday, because yesterday was St. Patrick's Day. Any Irishman here? This came from an Irishman. He said that he told me that this poor man, he worked in the Guinness factory in Dublin. And this man worked in the Guinness factory in Dublin, and unfortunately he fell in the vat and drowned, the vat of Guinness. And so one of his friends had to go to his wife and tell her the sad news. I'm terribly sorry, but your husband, he died, he drowned in the vat of Guinness, you know, the Guinness, the beer today. And she was just so upset. She said, "Didn't anybody try to pull him out?" "Oh yeah, we pulled him out several times, but he kept jumping back in." That's a Patrick's Day joke. Okay, first question is from Slovenia. How can I carefully remove the importance of thinking in meditation? I know thinking doesn't help, so I get quiet, but then the thoughts come again. How can I create more stillness? Thank you. Okay, in the meditation, if you do get quiet in meditation, bring the joy into the quietness and value that. Give it a bit of a smile. If you give the smile to the peace and the stillness, it becomes more attractive. It's like putting makeup on the stillness to make it more attractive. And then the mind stays with it. So sometimes bringing negativity to thinking, taking away its importance, sometimes that's too negative. Put the positivity into the stillness. Make stillness more important. Forget about making thinking negative. And every time in your life when you go to a still place, maybe you go into the bush somewhere, or even jhana grove is a really still, quiet place sometimes when there's nobody there working and there's no wind. It's incredibly peaceful. I'm sure you know your peaceful, still places. When you actually come to a place of stillness, really allow it to resonate with you. Because the more you experience physical stillness, the more you will value the stillness in your mind. It's one of the reasons why monks like me like meditating in caves. Instead of some of the stillest places in the world, go to these beautiful deep caves, they're cool, they're silent, and you can't hear anything. I used to go to this monastery in the north of Thailand, deep cave. Stay all day in there. And then you come out afterwards, there was a storm, lightning. Couldn't hear a thing inside the cave. Brilliant. So quiet. And the external quietness would make you inside quiet. So to create more stillness, don't give negativity to the thoughts. Just give more positivity and more value to the stillness. Oops. From Ireland. From Adrian. So, happy St. Paddy's Day yesterday, Adrian. When I meditated, I get a sudden rush of bliss running up from my spine, but I find that brings up emotions of wanting and sensual yearning. How do we deal with this, with metta? Okay, this is a meditation question. That when you do meditate, it's best to try and let go of your body as soon as possible. So, if you're watching, say, your breathing, please don't tie the feeling of the breath to anywhere in your body. If you tie it to the tip of the nose, it's like the mind is connected still to the body. If you just know the breath going in, going out, you don't know where it is on the body, that means you cut off the body really quickly. And so if you do get bliss, it doesn't run up your spine, it stays in your mind where it belongs. So that when it goes up the spine, sometimes in some traditions that they call that the sort of start of Kundalini, I really don't think that's a good way to go. I've seen too many problems with that, and also you're wasting the energy. It should really go into the mind, not the body. So see if you can, whatever you meditate, to not tie a breathing onto your nose or your belly or anywhere on your body. And it's much better. Okay, Tim from USA, who is meditating when there is no self? When you asked that question, you certainly weren't meditating. So if you're meditating, you can't answer that question. So who is meditating? When you asked that question, you weren't meditating at all. So the answer was no one. So when you do meditate, you don't ask questions like that. Okay. Now, are there any questions from the floor today? Yeah, thank you. Okay, this is the old solipsism, that your perception is yours, my perception is mine.
So, if our waking and sleeping perceptions of reality are all subjective, is reality, when we're all meditating, the same?
No, the thing is, that the first thing is not subjective, because we are all influence one another. Put it in a crude way, you are subject to brainwashing. I have aligned your perceptions with mine by teaching you over the last 45 minutes. So, and because we are social beings, we meet with one another, that is actually why our perceptions start to resonate together. So we actually share perceptions. People who actually stay by themselves for long periods of time, and they don't have social connections. They don't read books or listen to TV or something. They really are in solitude. Then they can very easily go crazy, because their perception just moves away from other people. And it's so different that it's actually strikingly different.
So you're saying that reality is...
We share it.
But it's something that we all create.
We all create, yes. We all, you know, like those scientists, they block out so much of what was real. Because it goes against their view. Yeah. For the matter of insight and seeing the truth of things, we have to overcome the causes for denial, which is actually suspending our views so that, you know, we can see things as they truly are. We won't bend things at all to suit ourselves. No desire, no denial to see things as they truly are. In Buddhism, that's called overcoming the five hindrances. The hindrances and the first two are desire and ill will, which actually stop the mind seeing the truth. We see what we want to see. And in the case of those scientists in Imperial College, we just cannot see what we don't want to, because it challenges us too much. Some of the stuff you see here is actually can be quite frightening. Very challenging to see things in a new way. It's challenging to be free. Going back to the simile of the prisoner in jail. It's very challenging to walk out of jail. But in the end, it's worth it. So thank you for that question. Okay. Sorry, I was a bit serious tonight and not so much bubbly, and but I just come back from Sydney, so I hope that's okay for everybody. Hope you had a nice, deeper talk this evening. So we'll now go and bow three times to the Buddha, Dhamma, and Sangha, and then please, you're most welcome to come up and ask a few questions afterwards.
Arahang Sama Sambuddho Bhagava Buddhang Bhagavantang Abhivademi Suvakato Bhagavata Dhammo Dhammang